Welcome to the Fangled Cast, brought to you by the folks at Fangled Group, the strategy-first marketing and sales consultancy helping take your company to the next level and beyond. We help our clients convert every touch into voracious advocates for their brand. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Fangled Cast. Today's going to be interesting. I know I lured you in with that question, is qualitative research bullshit? And we're going to get to that in a minute. We're going to answer that question because it's important. And the reason that we're here today is because of my incredible guest, Grant Gooding, who is an expert in qualitative research. And rather than me screw up his bio, I'm going to start by asking you, is qualitative research bullshit? And who is Grant Gooding and why do you think you're on the show?
What order do you want me to go in? You want me to answer it first?
Yes.
Is qualitative research bullshit? No, it's not.
Good. Now, who are you? We'll get to why no later.
My name is Grant Gooding. I have a company in Kansas City called Proof Positioning. I was a misfit mergers and acquisitions analyst for the first part of my career. Abandoning the law side and hyper-focusing on analysis. And the area that I really gravitated towards was measuring the immeasurable. And everything in a transaction is quanted out very well, right? So it's all finance documents and numbers, and that's how the multiples work. And I was very interested more in integration. So when we bring two companies together, or we have one company that buys another company, how does the leadership structure work? How does the culture fare out? And how do the customers play a role in that? And through that analysis, I focused heavily on qualitative analysis, as you do.
Yep.
And started discovering that there were some that it was the best method that existed that we knew of, but maybe that there were some things that we could do differently that might be able to garner deeper insight. And so messed around with a few methods and figured out a pretty intriguing way, which we can talk about, to quantify emotional resonance, which allows us to, in many ways, quant out qualitative information. So we, a lot of times, come in behind. If someone has done qualitative analysis on a population for a study or a rebrand or an agency or whatever, and we kind of come in behind that and quant out a lot of that qual. So I've transitioned from exclusively doing qualitative analysis to doing quant analysis, and so I have an interesting sort of perspective on both, I would say.
Yeah, you know, I kind of want to take a step back really quick to kind of let the audience know how we met. A mutual friend of ours from Madison, Wisconsin's, I think it's their marketing group, had put out a program having you on as a guest. Is qualitative research destroying your marketing or something like that?
Yeah.
And I joked with him and said, yeah, I'm gonna come on because we do as a core part of Fangled. Qualitative research for understanding customers, for our clients to understand what their needs, desires, all this kind of stuff. He's welcome on. And through the whole thing, I decided to stay quiet because, you know, I'm going to come on and I'm going to tell this speaker what's what, and sat there and listened to just great information. And the conclusion from that, which we'll talk about, is that most qualitative research that's ruining people's marketing is really because they don't know how to do it. or what the way that they're doing it isn't valuable to finding the results that they're looking for. Would you say that's a fair statement?
I think that is a fair statement. It is an art form, to be sure. And fortunately, it's one of those disciplines where anyone can step in and do it. And all you have to do is meet up with a customer or a prospect and ask them a few questions. But what I talk was to make folks wary of the pitfalls, a few of the pitfalls, one being lying.
Yeah.
Intentional and unintentional lying. And because they are real things. And if you don't know how to navigate that, don't know how to follow up from that, you aren't going to get anything you're not going to get to truth. You're not going to get to substance. And unfortunately, a lot of people take what people say and run with it.
Yep.
And that's when their communication plan typically gets ruined, is because they just have bad raw data. And so they work with variations of bad data, and it doesn't matter how many variations you create, you've still got a bad starting point. And so that was, the kind of point of that.
It's interesting. Just last week, I was talking to a potential client, and they handed me the results of a written survey that they did. And there were several pieces of it that stood out. I think you'll find this fascinating. One is they used the ratings to do math with. So if you rated, do you like something? 1, I hate it. 10, I love it. A 5 is only half as good as a 10. Rather than so that was one part of it. But the other part that stood out to me that I think is key to our conversation is they didn't quite understand that you send out 10,000 surveys and you get 100 back, what you really have is the data from people who are willing to fill out surveys, not necessarily the 10,000 people that you want to deal with. And, for the qualitative side, if you're doing focus groups and you're doing, individual interviews with folks, what are some of the pitfalls that you had brought up as to why the data would be skewed at the beginning? I know one was lying, and we'll kind of go from there.
Oh, on the call side. Well, back when I was doing a lot of qual analysis, one of the biggest concerns that I had right off the bat was, one, naturally gravitating towards good ideas. And what was hard to, when you hear something that seems insightful, that doesn't necessarily mean it's true. It just means that was a really insightful idea, but that doesn't necessarily mean that if you were to scale that across an entire population or subpopulation, that's reality. And that's kind of hard to wrap your head around, because most people, and especially inside of an organization, when they hear that, they're like, oh man, that's really cool. They're like, well, it may be cool, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's true. Mm-hmm. One major pitfall. We are naturally gravitate towards those kind of interesting ideas. The second thing I was always concerned about, if I did have the right information, can I scale this out? Is this true? I heard 3 people say something. If it's in a focus group, how much of that is groupthink? If it's in an individual conversation, maybe more reliable because it's independent. But is that necessarily, I'm always worried about how big my sample is. So what's my end value? And that was really the fundamental reason that I shifted from doing qual to quant, is if we could figure out a way to create some measurement around ideas that come out of good qual, then we can more responsibly scale it out as a strategy. And it certainly comes with its limitations, right? There are very specific circumstances, like around creative, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
We create what we call guardrails. And you have to run with, from a creative perspective, you have to run with those, with the ideas that come out of those guardrails, but it does not directly inform, it might inform the brief, but it doesn't necessarily inform the creative. And I think really good people that know how to do qual and do qual well can dump ideas directly into a creative manifestation product or something like that. And that's something that's hard to do from a quant.
One of the points that you made the last time I heard you, you were talking about how human memory is one of the leading problems that exist in doing this type of analysis. Can you dig a little bit into that for us?
Yeah, so I dug a little bit into kind of understanding memory. We sort of geek out about neuroscience over here and behavioral economics. And I got turned on to flashbulb studies, which are fascinating. And most of the time, someone that's doing poor qual analysis, I would say, would ask for reflection. And that right there is a huge red flag that we look for if we're reviewing some initial research, is how much reflecting was being done around a past decision or a past memory. And one of the pitfalls with that is how human beings remember things. So the flashbulb studies will teach us that over about a 10-year frame, there is approximately 40% decrease in the recall of specific details around major life events, right? So major life events have substantially higher probability of having details be remembered, like weddings and birth of children and disasters, car accidents, things like that. So the example that I think I used in that one was 9/11.
Right.
And actually, one of the largest flashbulb study that's ever been done. I think it went across 13 different universities and they had thousands of people. And they had them write down specific types of details surrounding 9/11. And it was like the next day that they do this. It's like immediate. And one of them was, you know, one of them was, who are you with? What were you doing at the time? Who did you tell? What did you do after you found out? And then they would have them write down their answers. And then they would go back and revisit these answers over time. And it's really bizarre to see the number of people that were like, well, I don't know why I wrote that down because that's not true. And what's fascinating is that your mind will unintentionally fill in the blanks of details, even though where we forgot a few details and we told the story. And when we tell the story, it can fill in a reality in our own mind, which is horrifying because that means you have someone that's technically telling the truth. It's just incorrect.
Yep.
And that is, so it's a major pitfall of communication. So, you know, we had to figure out a way to around how do you measure someone's emotional resonance of something that's current or in the future, because looking just like in qual, if you're talking about looking back, there's a high probability that you're getting bad detail recall around a purchasing moment or a memory or any type.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You know, I had an experience just recently with that myself, and I've always prided myself at having a really good memory. So I decided to rewatch a series that had been on television, 8 seasons, 20 something episodes a season. And I remembered in my head the first episode as if it was yesterday. And when I watched the first episode, it picked up right in the middle of the story. And I realized that what had happened was all of the exhibition, the beginning of the story through the first 3 episodes that told you the backstory of the characters and all that kind of stuff, created a fake episode in my head that was the first episode that I've been remembering for years.
As like so, referring to it as the first episode?
Yeah, in my head, I had the first episode they never made because everything that was in my first episode was disclosed through the drama of the first 3 episodes.
It's terrifying. I remember reading some of that and just looking at certain memories. And I actually called people, like I called my roommate at the time that I was living with after grad school about 9/11. And we had similar recollections until it came to what did we do after? And we were totally on the wrong. One of us is right and one of us is wrong. But I don't know which one, even though we both swear that happened. And I talked to my wife. My wife went on a cruise before we had kids, and we were sailing around Greece, and a volcano erupted. And I said, it was after I read this, and I was trying to get her perception of the event. She is convinced that we slept through it, which is true. We agreed on. To her, it was a nap. And to me, it was in the middle of the night. And we could not agree on, one of us is right. I don't know which one.
Yep.
It might be a significant detail and it may seem inconsequential, but if you're a researcher trying to do analysis on the purchase of a product or a service, that detail could be the difference between winning and losing.
Yep.
And so it is wildly significant.
Yeah.
So.
My favorite of those stories, when I was a college kid, I was a member of a fraternity. I never once drank any alcohol the entire time I was in college. It just wasn't something I did, but I'm a fun guy. I tell jokes, I goof around, whatever. Every time I would go back for fraternity reunion after 20 years away, the guys would talk about that time that we just remember drinking a case of beer together and the chaos that ensued and the craziness and how drunk I was. And everybody has these memories and I absolutely can certify there's no chance in any way, shape or form that they're true, but all of these people have the memory of me behaving that way because, well, of course they were drunk at the time, but
yeah.
So, you know, it's I think it's one of the parts of the conversation that that's so interesting. But from a marketing perspective, if everyone is living in a false narrative of the history, but you know what it is that they believe happened, can't that be leveraged?
I think so, absolutely. It's just a matter of whether or not that false reality is consistent. And if it is consistent, then does reality really matter? Because for the sake of research and for the sake of marketing, reality is really not something that we have to abide by. Mm-hmm. You know, there are lots of times where you look at behavioral purchase data and say, well, they actually did this. And many times our response is, well, we actually don't care. Mm-hmm. What they did in reality and what they believe are two distinctly different things.
Mm-hmm.
I only care about what they believe. And
exactly.
What they believe, and it happens to be different than what reality is, it's still reality.
So yep. We always tell clients that if there isn't a real differentiator between you and your competition, but there is a perceived differentiator, it's just as powerful.
It's exactly the same. I mean, there are lots of organizations that have these distinct brand associations that in reality don't exist. Yep. Most built around quality or execution and things that aren't reality. You know, a friend of mine is a audio engineer that owns a company that wholesales audio, so high-end audio equipment
for, sure.
A wholesaler, right? And, you know, it's one of those guys that, and I said, I have a Bose home system in one of my TVs. And I think it's just like, they just think it's the bee's knees. And he's like, Bose actually isn't all that good. I'm like, wait a minute. What are you talking about? Like, Bose is light years ahead of everybody else. And he's like, not even close.
Yep.
What are you talking about? He's like, no, here's like these. And he's talking about all these different brands and why like Bose levels and stuff aren't as good. And like, my reality is that there's nothing better than Bose. And I've been trained to think that because of conversations around people that, to be quite frank, are ignorant, right? Because I'm not an audio engineer. And yep. Not people that I'm talking to who understand, you know, what sound frequencies are. And they have really incredible marketing that depicts them as like the Rolex of sound.
Right.
And no reason to challenge that. And so the reality of Bose's quality is irrelevant, because in my head it was, until I get educated another way. And now I'm stuck in this reality where I don't know what to buy.
Yeah. But do you like the sound of what you have?
Yeah. See,
I
think it's great.
Yep. It's one of those fascinating pieces of perception. There's lots of products out there that have the reputation of being superior by the brand. Years ago, there was, when I was young, the top reel-to-reel and cassette decks that were out there was this company, TEAC, T-E-A-C. They went out of business in the 80s, I think, because nobody was buying reel-to-reels anymore, and the brand. So a Chinese company was able to buy out of, I don't know if it was out of a bankruptcy, I don't know for fact, bought the name and put out a line of really crappy audio equipment with that name. And it sold like crazy because the brand equity of it, if it's made by TEAC. I mean, it goes back, my brother, when he was looking to buy a wedding ring for his wife, my grandmother kept telling him, you have to go to this store downtown, so-and-so, and gave the name of it because they're the best in town. Well, when was the last time you were in there, grandma? We got married, and was it 1920? You know, it was one of those where the brand equity created this false sense that if they were so great to me 60 years ago or 50 years ago, whatever it was, they must be now. And this is, again, going back to that whole process of qualitative analysis, is that as you're individually interviewing with folks, getting past the fact that they want you to like them, they may lie, not knowing they're lying, they may have all of these things that we're talking about. The quality guys who do this qualitative analysis it isn't so important whether it's the truth, it's whether it's believed and how you can use those beliefs to build your marketing strategy going forward. And do you take the extra step of testing to see if what happened in that microcosm of that interview actually expands across all people?
Well, and that's what our company focuses on specifically.
Yep.
And it's a two-step process, and either one on its face is only half baked. And sometimes there's calls for one, not the other, and it's resource dependent based. Another thing I thought of when you were talking about those beliefs is I think someone that understands those can also help an organization understand the barrier.
Mm-hmm.
So the mind is real, real stubborn. And, I'll tell you a story. There's a project we worked on years ago with a town. I can say what town it is, but there is a city, and the city was upwind from a live animal plant, right? Like a hog farm or chicken farm. And, we were working on something that was around tourism, and someone said in the meeting from the city council, can you find out if we have if our town smells? And we were like, what? And we said, okay. And we asked a question, and unaided, it was over a third of people indicated that had visited the town within the past like 3 years that it smelled. And we were like, oh my gosh, that's unbelievable. You have a smelly town, right? Like, it's real.
Stinkville.
They were like, yeah, it's kind of something that is, a stigma that we've been battling. Here's what's fascinating. That plant had been closed for over a decade. But the reality is, when you visit the town and there's something that concretes in your head, in this instance, the town stinks, what happens the next time you visit and it doesn't smell? Does it not smell in your head? Probably not.
Yep.
There's a barrier that exists that your brain put in. And that is, the town doesn't smell today. And yep. So how do you conquer that barrier? Because it's an emotional and a psychological barrier. How do you conquer that? It's extremely difficult.
Yep. I live in Cleveland, and in 1960, whatever it was, went back in the industrial age of Cleveland, the Cuyahoga River caught on fire. And Lake Erie was polluted. The river was awful. You could see chunks of brown air floating through the air in Cleveland. Now those industries have all cleaned up or gone. The river's so clean, it's got healthy fish. You can go fishing. We go kayaking. All these things happen. But to this day, it's the city with the burning river.
Yeah.
And it's been 50 years.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
The mind is a very stubborn organ.
It is. It is. So can you maybe, as we're getting kind of near the end of our time together here, can you give an example of a company that's direction was changed by your work, and how, without necessarily disclosing who they are, but what the case was presented as, what you guys discovered that was different and how it affected them?
But I would say one that kind of pops out of my head is it's a technology company, technology service. Sure. Founded, we're founded in the Midwest, and so we're in Kansas City. So Kansas City had a department here, and the marketing department had instructed the sales team to specifically avoid one message, and it was a message around, it was a totally in the weeds message. And I, on its face, you would look at it and be like, look, you don't want to get into the weeds in a sales conversation. Makes total sense, right? I wouldn't have disagreed with it on its face. And we found that it was the most emotionally resonant idea around a specific role, a chief information officer, in almost every one of their target companies.
Mm-hmm.
And so so they created their own collateral because they didn't have any collateral around it, because the marketing department had said, we don't you know, we don't talk about this. This is something that gets addressed post, you know, post client acquisition. And so they started doing it, and they went from the second worst performing district, sales district in the country to the second best in 1 year with the same sales folks. And they attributed that success to that one message. Now they fast forward a few years and they've grown dramatically, and they attribute more sales to that message than anything else. And it was something that was always just sitting there. And it was just using your intuition and saying, this probably isn't a good thing that we should be talking about. And it was, but with a specific person and in a specific situation. And once they were able to unlock that insight, you know, they ran with it. It's
amazing what happens when you finally turn the lights on to something that's that powerful.
Yeah,
really cool. Is there anything before we wrap up, is there anything I didn't ask you about that I should have that would bring more light to what we're talking about today?
No, I appreciate people that do good qual. It's tough to find people that do good qual. And when you combine good qual and good quant, the organization is going to have a major advantage over anybody else. And so I appreciate the two sides of a coin and Andrew, I appreciated the fact that we both have respect for the other side of the coin, and
absolutely.
I look forward to hanging out more.
Yeah, me too. I'm really glad to have you on. And by the way, the audience, just to be clear, the answer to the question is qualitative bullshit. The answer is no, unless it is. Unless it is, and my personal opinion, which I normally don't throw into this, is I've seen really, really bad qualitative research destroy marketing strategy and ruin companies. But I've seen great stuff that turned companies from midgets to monsters and really grew and did great work.
Well, look at, I mean, P&G. P&G uses, they have always been ahead of the game on qual, right? Back starting in the 60s and doing observational stuff. And they have category killers in all of their categories for a reason.
Yep.
It's because they were really great at qual.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you again for coming on. For those of you at home, all of the contact information to get in touch with Grant and his company will be in the notes. We hope that if there was something here that got you thinking about how to improve your business using qualitative or quantitative analysis, you'll reach out. And thank you so much. Please remember to subscribe, share, I don't know, shoot fireworks off, fax a friend, do whatever you need. Let people know about the FangleCast, and we will see you all in the next episode. Thanks so much.
The Fangled Cast is brought to you by the great people at the Fangled Group, where we help you convert every touch into voracious advocates for your brand.